Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Smart Talks. I'm Elizabeth Smart, and I'm here with my co-host, Mio Strong, and we are so lucky to have an incredible woman with us joining us today. Her name is Julie Whitehead. She is not only physically beautiful, but she's a beautiful example of courage and strength, and she is a survivor, and she is here to talk with us today. So I'm very, very excited and honored to have you with us, Julie. Thank you for joining us. Diving right straight in, I am wondering if you could just give everyone a brief overview of what your story is. And
So first of all, I'm a wife and mother. I have six amazing kids, which I never thought I would have six children, but my husband had two, so I have two stepchildren, and then I brought three in from a previous marriage, and we adopted one. So I'm a full-time mom and wife, and I've just recently been getting involved with advocacy work and been doing some speaking engagements in connection and in support of the Maloof Foundation and some of their initiatives, which they are trying to eradicate sex trafficking, human sex trafficking. And so they're doing some really amazing things there. So I've been volunteering with that. But I have a very long history. I have 31 year history of abuse, different types of abuse. Unfortunately, it went from one type to the next very quickly with no space in between. So started out in childhood as sexual abuse and went right into my first relationship with a boy that I actually married, and that was some domestic violence inside of that marriage. And then unfortunately I thought I found a rescuer from that, and he happened to be a sex trafficker. So my history just kind of snowballed into, every time I thought it couldn't get worse, it did. And so I have extensive history in all of those forms of abuse. But the past 5 years I've been in therapy and been healing, and I feel like I've made some huge strides. I feel like my life is more on track and I'm more in control. I found my voice. And so I'm starting to find a way to do something positive with all the negative that I've experienced.
One of my questions for you, I mean, you do have such an extensive history of abuse. And I mean, personally, I only remember times while I was kidnapped that I thought my life actually cannot get worse. This has got to be rock bottom. And every time I thought that, I unfortunately found out, as it sounds like you did too, that yes, things always can get worse. And so after hearing, I mean, just very briefly about what you've experienced and what you've gone through, I'm wondering, what was the final turning point for you? I mean, what helped trigger you to get out of these relationships, and what's helped you to, you know, find this place of where you are today? I mean, it seems like you're more at peace with the world, and that you have a passion for changing, for educating, for being an advocate for survivors. I mean, was there one thing that you can attribute this change in life at?
Yeah, definitely. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make that change for myself. As hard as I kept trying, I just found that I got myself in deeper and deeper. So really for me, it took somebody on the outside to see me and to recognize some signs that something wasn't quite right and to intervene. And I really needed to be rescued. And it was not something that I felt I could do for myself. And I definitely wasn't strong enough at that point either, having just come out of all the previous abuses. But I definitely have a passion for educating people about the signs to look for people that are being abused in all different sorts, forms of abuse, because I think sometimes it does take an external source to help get out of that situation.
And what are some of those signs? I mean, because someone wrote me on Instagram the other day, and they're like, you know, what are things that I can look for? And I was like, you know what, I've got like a couple ideas, or like I've got not just ideas, I mean, they've been facts that I've learned over the years, but mm-hmm. What are some of those suggestions that you can give? I mean, I would love to expand my resources of facts that I can give people, or not even just facts, but of signs to look for.
Yeah, well, I'll speak specifically to trafficking just to narrow it down a little bit. There's a lot of signs. And they don't all apply to every person, of course. Everybody is unique and different. But there's signs such as not speaking for yourself, having somebody speak for you, not making eye contact. It can go clear to having somebody's name tattooed on their neck. Staying at different locations, traveling, and the airport. Just recently, when I traveled, my husband was holding my driver's license for me and handed it to the whatever you call him. I'm sorry, I can't think of it. And the security, and he said, this is actually a sign of human trafficking when somebody's holding the passports or the identification for the other people. So there's a lot of kind of subtle signs. And it's tricky because you might see some of those signs in healthy people or in situations that are just fine. But there's something to look for and just something to key your mind into that if you see that, maybe look a little bit harder. And if I can give this website out, it's iamonwatch.org. It's a training and education platform that teaches you what signs to look for human trafficking. And then also, more importantly, maybe, is what to do when you see those signs. And of course, that's referring to calling the human trafficking hotline or 911 if it's applicable. So yeah, I think we as a society just need to know what to look for, and then of course, what to do when we see it.
And Julie, do you mind expanding a little bit on your trafficking experience? I know one of the things when I read your story that really hit home was just that it can happen to anyone at any time, in any demographics, any, socioeconomic status, it doesn't matter. And I think part of the shock is how close to home your story is. And I think it can really help shed some light, if you don't mind sharing some details.
Yeah, no, of course, I'd be happy to. So I saw this quote online. It said, "Child abuse occurs at every socioeconomic level across ethnic and cultural lines, within all religions, and at all levels of education." And it just struck me that that was talking about child abuse, but that is the same for trafficking. And I would never have guessed that. Before it happened to me, my only experience with it was in a movie, maybe. And if you would have asked me who was a victim of human trafficking, I would have said it was somebody in a third world country, overseas, maybe a developing country. And it's just not true. It's happening here in our borders, domestically. It's happening in every state, in every culture, just like the child abuse. It crosses all lines. For me, I didn't know what I was involved in was human trafficking until I got into therapy. And then they told me, well, there's a name for what you've been through, and it's human sex trafficking. And I was floored. I still, at that point, even though I had endured it and survived it and was healing from it, I still didn't recognize it as human sex trafficking. And I think there's just a lot of misnomers about it. It typically happens with somebody you know. It's very rare that you're just kidnapped off the street and taken by surprise. It's usually somebody you know that can groom you. In my case, it was a father of, I was teaching preschool, and it was a father of one of my students. And he just slowly over the course of the year got to know me a little bit better. And I was in an abusive marriage at the time, so I was very hesitant about making friends, especially with a male. But he was so understanding. And the thing that's so insidious about these traffickers are they're master manipulators. And so they pick up on your needs, what you're lacking, and they try to supply that to you. And so I was very much alone and feeling he said, "I think something's going on in your marriage," and he was very sympathetic. And it actually touched my heart because I thought somebody is actually seeing me, because I had felt so invisible with all the abuse I endured. I just felt like I was hidden in plain sight. And so over the year, he just kind of befriended me and gained my trust. He didn't cross any lines or push any boundaries. And then he started to come around when I was alone at the preschool at night. And that was a boundary for me that I didn't feel comfortable with. And I confided in my boss that this was happening. And together we drafted a text to him that said, you know, this is inappropriate conduct. We'd rather you didn't come to the school anymore. And he disappeared. He disappeared for more than 6 months. And then the very day that my ex-husband was arrested for domestic violence, he got in contact with me. And to this day, I have no idea how he knew to do that. At the time, he said that he felt he had been called by God to look after me. And it sounds a little bit crazy to believe something like that, but I was so low and so desperate and in need of support that I did think, you know, maybe he is a guardian angel of sorts. And so that was really the grooming process. He took 2 weeks after that to really solidify our relationship. And, you know, because of my history of abuse, I didn't know how to relate to men other than being in a relationship with them. And so I was very confused about the relationship. Is it a friendship? Is he a boyfriend? He kind of blurred the lines a little bit and made it difficult to know. But all I knew is that he cared deeply for me. He was there when I needed him. He was a support. He was caring. And I just felt lucky, you know, I felt lucky to have found this person. But then 2 weeks into it, he raped me. And the whole relationship changed. It became one of power, of dominance, of control. And from that point on, he forced me to do things that I was not comfortable with, but he used threats against my children, my family. It was terrible. He took photos and threatened to distribute them to tarnish my reputation. And at the time I was also, you know, up to my neck in a divorce hearing and in a custody hearing for my children. And so he used that against me, saying that this would affect my chances to get custody with my kids. And so he had all this dirt, for lack of a better word, on me that he was saying that he was willing to spread and that he would go to my ex-husband and collaborate with him to help me lose custody. So it was very, I felt very trapped. I didn't feel like there was any way out. And the further I got into it, the more trapped I was. And so it was just a terrible situation. And it escalated to the point where he was taking me through many different states and trafficking me. And yeah, like I said, it took somebody to finally see something and say, this doesn't seem right, and ask some questions. And I was able to answer some of those questions. I took a chance, and this person was able to get me some help. And then I was able to get free, but it was a long journey.
Do you mind just going in, like, who was it? I mean, I think of my own childhood sexual abuse, and it was somebody seeing behaviors in me that really opened up the conversation and started me on the road to recovery. I'm curious who it was, or maybe just not names, but what type of relationship did you have with them? Or
yeah, sure. It's kind of crazy. So my trafficker he was a long haul, I think they call him over the road truck driver. And he wanted to purchase his truck from his employer. And long story short, he thought that if I was the one to ask for the deal, that it'd be more likely that that his employer would agree to it because I was a woman, and he thought he'd take pity on me and whatever. But so I ended up meeting with his boss directly because he told me to. And it was his boss that saw and said, what are you doing? What's going on? Things just don't add up for me. And yeah, he ended up questioning it. And I did take a chance and told him, you know, this person is keeping me against my will. And he said, you know, this is America. Nobody should live like that. And I'll do whatever I can to help you. And just having that support and just knowing that I was seen and somebody saw me and I wasn't invisible. And it gave me enough support to get through it and to get out, which was a really scary process and a really dangerous process. But I was able to get free. And the curious, or the kind of fascinating twist on that, is I married that man that is my husband now. So he's kind of a real Prince Charming in life. You know, he definitely saved me and I'm so grateful for that. But we had an amazing relationship. And I think because of some of the things we went through, we're just that much closer. So that was a happy ending to all of that.
I'm so grateful that you really explained how this man came into your life and started to groom you, because I think you're absolutely right. When you said that you didn't even know what you'd experienced was human trafficking, I think you hit the nail on the head, because I think there are so many women, not even just women, men too, children, who experience, I mean, whether it's trafficking or rape or domestic violence, they think because it's happening to them, it couldn't possibly have that label stuck on it. But it's so important. I'm like so appreciative of you sharing your story, because that is so important, because there are just so many people who think what happens to them is not abuse or is not rape or is not human trafficking. And I think especially because they do know the perpetrator, they do know the person who was hurting them. I mean, I know I've shared this story before in the past and I'll probably continue to share it, but I will never forget one of the most one of my most altering experiences as far as advocacy goes, and realizing just how important speaking out and sharing my story and trying to educate people on what rape and sexual assault is, was back when I was a correspondent for Crime Watch Daily. And I interviewed these girls who they had gone to college, and all three of them had been raped, and they all knew their rapist, but they didn't know what had happened to them was rape, because they knew their rapist. I mean, one was a boyfriend and he was doing things that were brutal. I mean, he was drugging her. He changed the lock on her apartment. He had cameras set up in her room so he could watch her. I mean, it was just appalling, really. But then because she felt like, you know, because he was her boyfriend, that she had willingly engaged in activities, that it was her fault and that it wasn't rape. I remember just sitting there thinking, no, this is not okay. And she told me how, you know, years down the road from then, someone eventually came to her and said, what you've experienced is rape and this is not okay. But I mean, just for the average person, I mean, she felt like a need to go and confess what had happened to her religious leader. And she did, but she didn't use the word rape. She used the word sex. So it was taken as, you know, as sex. And so then that just, I mean, it caused further detriment. That's why it's so important to have these kinds of conversations like what we're having right now, so people do understand and can be educated and know what to look for. And even if someone says it was consensual sex, they're still able to read between the lines to really see, was it consensual sex? I mean, it shouldn't just be consensual sex, it should be enthusiastic sex. And anything outside of enthusiastic sex is unacceptable. So I'm just so appreciative of you being willing to share your experience with that, because I do think that there is so much gray and there are so many victims who end up suffering so much more because they don't think that they deserve help, but they think that somehow it's their fault.
Definitely. When I was in my first marriage that was abusive, it sounds very similar to this person that you're speaking of. He had the cameras, changed the locks on the doors. He did all sorts of things like this. And he would tell me outright that it was he called it my wifely duty to please him in any way sexually. And that I did not, you know, once I said I do, I no longer had rights to my body. And unfortunately, because of the abuse that I suffered prior, I already had a mentality like that, that my body was not my own, that it didn't have rights and boundaries were inapplicable. And so in that marriage, when it ended, I actually told an attorney, I think it was, that he had raped me. And I was so scared to use that word because I didn't know if it applied because I was married to him. And I thought, you know, when you get married, maybe you hand over your rights to your body. And that's just so not true and so wrong. And I had the same thing happen with my trafficker, I thought, because I knew him, because I didn't know if he was a boyfriend or, you know, what really the relationship was defined as, I, again, didn't know that I had rights to my body. And I thought, I actually told somebody that he was just a really horrible boyfriend. And I mean, that's putting it so mildly for what he did. But yeah, I think it's so, so important that we have these talks that your body is yours and you have the right to say no, and you have the right to own your body, and you decide what happens to it and when. And like you said, anything short of that is not okay.
And as you've mentioned, I mean, I have three children now. Mio has children as well. And I feel, I mean, my children are all very, very young right now. But I mean, I wonder for you as a parent now, and of a combined family as well, how do you communicate with your children? How are you planning on, and I'm sure you're already doing it, but how do you teach them to what's safe and what's not? I know this is a question that I get asked all the time. And so I also love to hear other people's perspectives on it. And I appreciate it so much.
Yeah, I have a lot of work to do there still. I've been working on myself a lot for the last 5 years. It's been very intense therapy. And I've come up with a lot of ideas and things that I think, gosh, I wish that my parents would have said this. My parents really didn't have any sort of talk with me about what sex was. And I found out the hard way, as it was. And I don't want to repeat that. I want my kids to know that it can be a wonderful, beautiful part of a relationship, and that their bodies are their own and they need to value themselves and value their own rights. And so I have some work there that I still need to do with my own kids, to be honest with you. It's a hard subject to broach sometimes, and it's a little awkward. You know, well, she's not my youngest anymore. She's 15, but she's not real excited to have those kind of talks with mom or dad right now. But I think it's hugely important. I wonder, had I had those talks, had somebody given me more information, what turns might I have avoided in my life?
Yeah, I think that's my daughter. One of my daughters is 13, and it's hard. It's really hard to have those conversations and to know when the timing's right or how to even frame it. So I understand. And I think any parent never has it all figured out. We're all trying, and it's all a daily struggle. But I think the important thing is you know where to take it and you're learning how to take it there. And that's really big. I have this like mama bear instinct in me over so many people that we talk to. And I'm curious, was justice ever served to any of your abusers or your trafficker, or are they still out there? And I'm just curious, what's happened that way with them?
Yeah, so my ex-husband was arrested for domestic violence, and he faced a hearing about that. At the time, I was so afraid. Well, I was just barely free from him, and I was so afraid to make him mad at me because I didn't know how he'd retaliate, and especially with the kids at stake, that I wasn't willing to push hard on getting justice in that sense. And so he took a plea in abeyance, which they told me is basically a guilty plea, but that it will be expunged from his record. I think it was a year after. And I really left it at that with him. And you know, I still find myself trying to tippy-toe around him and not set him off because I'm afraid of how that will affect my children, because it always does. And they tend to end up as pawns in the middle, and that's horrible, and I can't have that. So that's kind of where that's left at. I still have to interact with him. My kids aren't all 18 yet, and so I have years left of that, and that's a struggle and a constant worry for me. My trafficker, it turned out that he was arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He had actually perpetrated some further rapes after I was able to get free from him. When I found out about that, I was so riddled with guilt because it's illogical, but I thought I should have done something to prevent that from happening to these future victims. And really, you know, if I think about it, what would I have done? But I found out that he was in jail for those charges and some others that I'm not even aware of. And he had a hearing before the Department of Homeland Security for deportation. And I was currently in Tennessee at the time seeking treatment. And I found out about it in this kind of roundabout way. And I just felt like I had to tell my story, that I had to make sure the judge knew what he had done to me and take that into consideration when he made his ruling. And so kind of at the 11th hour, they were already in court. They were almost to the end of it, finishing stages. And they got my letter saying I'm willing to testify. And they pulled me in and I testified, I think it was over 3 different days, and told my entire story to them, left no detail out. It was very difficult. He was there, not present in person, but on a big screen TV from jail. And it was ugly. It was horrible. It's not fun at all, but it was also really necessary, I felt like, to tell it and to make sure that the judge knew what this man was capable of and what he had actually already done, and that if he stayed, he was going to do it again, in my opinion. And so he was actually deported in 2016 back to his homeland country. And so that's given me a lot of peace knowing that he's gone. It's weird because you would think I would be so relieved and know that he's gone, but I still catch myself thinking I see him places. And so it's given me a lot of relief, but I still have it inside my mind. He'll always be in my mind. And that's something I can't really escape as easily. So I worry about his associates, I'll call them that, in crime. They're still here. You know, I didn't press charges against, I don't know who they are for one thing, or where to find them. So I didn't necessarily press the charges myself, but I was able to be involved. And he was finally deported. So I get to live my life knowing he's not going to show up somewhere at some point. So.
Wow. I mean, Julie, the courage and the bravery and just the tenacity, like, I'm so in awe of you. I can't imagine how incredibly difficult those testifying, and even if he was on a screen, I can't imagine how that would make you feel. So thank you. I mean, what a huge, huge step you took. That's amazing.
Well, I feel really good that he's not, I hope that he's not hurting people in his homeland country. I mean, that's not acceptable either, but I feel so glad that he's not hurting any more people here too. And hopefully he's changed his ways, but who knows. But that's the justice that I've received so far. And I think the biggest form of justice is getting free from them in my mind.
Yes.
I carry them around with me, and that day hasn't come yet, but I'm working towards it.
I mean, I hope you do know how strong you are. I mean, even by just getting up every day and being a mom every day and living for your children. I mean, I hope you know how much strength that takes after everything that you've gone through and what you still continue to do. I mean, whether you pursue a full time or not, I mean, that, like, you are a hero. And one day, as your children learn more and more about your past, I mean, they will certainly see that as well. And just the fact that even at that 11th hour, you found the will inside you to go and testify. I mean, I've been on the stand. It's not a pleasant place to be. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's really hard, and it's intimidating. And you know, my captor. Every day he came into the courtroom, you could hear the moment he was approaching, because he would be singing hymns, and he just keep singing. When the judge came in, the judge would always ask him to stop. He never did. And then he would be escorted out of the courtroom, and he would be taken to a holding room where he could watch the proceedings on the television. But so actually, I mean, I saw him every day. I feel like my trial went, not my trial, but his trial, my case went on it for 6 weeks, or for a long time, it felt like, anyways, every day. But every day he was escorted out. But I feel like it would have been, even though I saw him, it would have been much more difficult if I had to testify and he was sitting right in front of me. I mean, fortunately, he was escorted out every day, so I didn't have to do that. But the courage that it would have taken for you, I mean, even though he wasn't physically in the courtroom, still on a big screen, like right in front of you, that would be awful. That would be terrible. I mean, you know, thank goodness for, I'm not going to say justice system, but the legal system that we do have. But also that being said, it's definitely not a victim's, it's not a victim's legal system. It's definitely a perpetrator's legal system, and a lot of room for improvement and change in that. I want to applaud you for what you've done, because you're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. When he was in the courtroom, the last day I told myself, I'm going to look at him. Like, I just need to know that I can face him, that I can look at him, because prior to that, I had just, you know, averted my eyes and looked at the prosecutor or the defense attorney or whoever was speaking to me. And so the final day, I did take a few minutes and looked right at him, and he did not make eye contact with me. He looked down at the table. And that was kind of a big moment for me to just say, you know what, I did that, I faced him, and that was the last I've seen of him, and hopefully I'll never see that face again. So, but thank you. I know that when you were going through your court and everything, that was before, of course, before I had experienced all of my abuse, but you were very inspirational to me, so thank you for the courage that you had to do what you did, because that definitely played a part in my mind as I went through it.
Wow. Oh, thank you. That is awfully kind of you to say. I mean, I think we all need each other. I mean, we should all be on the same side. We should all be there supporting each other. And I feel like this is just another reason why sharing stories like yours, why this whole podcast is important, and why I feel like I want to keep doing it, because every victim, every survivor deserves support, and they deserve, I mean, they don't, it's not, the victim shouldn't be being the one being put up on trial, deciding whether or not they're worthy of our belief, or worthy of our support, or worthy of our understanding. I mean, that should just be a given. And so I'm just so grateful that you would agree to be here today. We are just about out of time. So I just want to say to everyone watching today's story, Julie, she's an example for us all. And if you feel like you have questions in your life, if you're wondering, well, wait a second, I never was fully comfortable with that relationship. I mean, I thought he was my boyfriend, but maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was a trafficker. Maybe he was something else. I mean, if you have questions, if you feel like you are scared from your partner, or if you are worried about people around you, you have the right to feel safe. You have the right to take steps to feel safe. I mean, call up your police station if you feel like you are in imminent danger. Once again, there are so many other amazing organizations out there that are there. There are resources for us. You call in to help. I mean, reach out to your local YWCA, look to your local advocacy centers. We have, as was mentioned, we've got a human trafficking hotline. You know, we've got all these different hotlines where people are open and available 24/7. So even if you just need someone to talk to, maybe ask questions, maybe you're confused about what you've experienced, don't be afraid to reach out. Don't be afraid to call them up, because you deserve to feel safe. You deserve to feel loved, to find happiness. You deserve to have the best life possible. And so I want to say thank you again so much to Julie, because you've been amazing today, and I so applaud what you're doing and how you're living your life and how you're moving forward and the courage that you have shown and continue to show. Thank you so much for joining us today. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And thank you to everyone who's taken the time to watch this episode and subscribe. Make sure you're staying safe. Make sure you are taking steps if you feel threatened, if you feel worried. We have resources available to us in the world. We have resources available to us in America, in this country. And if you're outside of America, there are many other agencies as well who are available for helping. So do not be afraid to reach out to them. That is why they are there. That being said, thank you again, and we'll see you all next time on another episode of Smart Talks. Goodbye.